Hi friends, I'm your host, Ivana Estelle, and welcome to True Crime Storytime's newest season, Serial Killers. I am not gonna lie, I am scared. Look, serial killers and all the goriness that goes with them freaks me out. Even a true crime justice advocate has their limits. But we're here, and I'm gonna share some hell of a story. But these stories are ones that need to be told nonetheless. So, let's get started, shall we? When I first heard about this case, it was from a friend of mine, Shinari. She's this kick-ass chef in New York and soon to be LA, and she sent me the case on a whim. I looked at it and set it down, thinking eventually I'll cover it. I came across the name again and realized that this case, at first, seemed like a one-off murder that was cracked in a theatrical way, but was actually something much more sinister. About a person who spent more than 50 years in prison, but still managed to commit heinous crimes. We had a serial killer on our hands. The victims were specific and could have been saved. Let me introduce you to Harvey Marceline. Before I start, I need to note that Harvey transitioned and identifies as a woman as of 2019, if not earlier, during her incarceration. However, during her first two murders, she went as Harvey Marceline. And so until we get to post-1985, I'm going to acknowledge Harvey as a male. Post that time, I will switch verbiage. Harvey Marceline has done horrific things. However, I do not want to ever disrespect what someone identifies as. And so I mean no negligence or ignorance for using he/him pronouns to start, and then she/her pronouns as we go along. I want to ensure I am not confusing our listeners while sharing the story, because this case is a doozy. Harvey was born in Harlem and raised in Brooklyn, New York. Harvey was born on May 21st, 1938, making him about 83 years old currently. And his life was one that was a bit odd, to say the least. We're going to start at the present. As I mentioned before, Harvey now goes by Marceline and identifies as a woman. She says there are two sides to her. Marceline, who is nice and gentle and loving with lots of laughter. She's a normal person you want to be around. But Harvey, he's not a good guy. He's a tough guy, and for the majority of Marceline's life, Harvey was playing the front man. But it seems Marceline has a side to her that is reactive as well. And no matter how you cut it, whether Marceline or Harvey, this person is a dangerous serial killer, and one that managed to take the lives of three people as we know it, while also spending over 50 years behind bars. Marceline recently did an interview with the New York Post, and she said that the women in her life have a tendency to provoke her. And when they do, the other side of her comes out. And that side is full of anger. Harvey grew up with a single mother prior to her transition. Harvey identified as a male. His mother was a seamstress, and his father died when Harvey was about 10. His parents grew up in Harlem, but moved to 158th Street in Washington Heights. Harvey recalled being spoiled because he was an only child. His mother was soft-spoken and a hard worker. Because of the long hours Harvey's mother worked, he was forced to stay at a daycare at the St. Aloysius Catholic Church on 132nd Street in Harlem. The church, according to Harvey, was run by very strict nuns who would beat him. He also accused him of sexual abuse and child neglect. Harvey believes it was there that changed his relationship with women. He recalled being 13 or 14 when he first tried on women's clothing. He felt like this was what was right, but was afraid to tell anyone. At this point, he was still in Catholic school, and when the school caught wind, now keep in mind this is 1952, court records show that Harvey was examined by a psychiatrist at the age of 14 because of his, quote, involvement with truancy, theft, heterosexual and homosexual activity, and cross-dressing. Now, a major portion of that sounds homophobic and ignorant, but it wasn't all. See, Harvey had also tried to commit his first actual crime, the attempted rape of an 8-year-old girl. There isn't much on her, which would make sense, her being a minor, but we do know that the Catholic Charities tried to get Harvey help through counseling. Not long after, at around 17 or 18, Harvey was left on his own. He worked as a copy machine operator for a while, but it wasn't long until his life of crime really began. According to court records, in 1957, he began an assortment of felonies pertaining to money. So, a burglary here and there. And sometime around then, he met a woman named Florence. Florence Jackson. Now, Florence and Harvey subsequently fell in love and got married, but Florence is never seen or heard from by police during the times that Harvey begins to really escalate. Not only that, but reporters can't find her to this day. And Harvey doesn't talk about her, like, at all. Which is why in 1963, when Jacqueline Bonds is murdered, it's shocking considering the fact that she is Harvey's girlfriend. Harvey is still married at this time, of course, but he falls head over heels for Jacqueline. She was beautiful. She was someone who was well-liked and close to their family. In April of 1963, Jacqueline had goals. She wanted to grow her career, settle down eventually, and have a family. There isn't much about her relationship with Harvey per se, but we do know he himself was having a rough time. A year prior, on April 2nd, 1962, Harvey voluntarily was admitted to Bellevue, which is a hospital psychiatric unit. He was discharged about 2 weeks later by his estranged wife, Florence. During the time he was admitted, the examining psychiatrist found that Harvey was not psychotic, but the hospital record does contain phrases like delusional grandiosity, suggestions of chronic schizophrenia, and paranoid reaction personality. A year later, we have no idea what happened to Florence, but we do know that Harvey was now dating Jacqueline. During the time of their relationship, Jacqueline was having second thoughts, and it may have been because Harvey's violence was rearing its ugly head again. See, less than a month prior, on March 14th, 1963, Harvey raped a woman named Clementine Benefield. There isn't much known about Clementine or her relationship with Harvey, but it is clear she knew her attacker. And on April 5th of 1963, Harvey was indicted on charges of attempted first-degree rape, second-degree assault, and second-degree burglary. Now, at this time, Harvey denied claims and begged for Jacqueline to believe him, so much so that he also needed her to testify at his trial as an alibi for where he was during the time of the burglary and assault. Jacqueline was beginning to get tired of this relationship, and around this time had decided to break things off with Harvey. Jacqueline let Harvey know that they were over, and now my question is, was she going to take the stand and testify that Harvey was with her, or out him for being a predator? Whatever the answer, we will never know. Because on April 18th, 1963, Jacqueline was in her apartment complex at 2216 8th Avenue in Manhattan. About five or six people, either neighbors, acquaintances, or strangers, were around in the apartment hallway area. That's when Harvey appeared. He entered the building and made his way to the apartment. He was able to get in most likely because he had become a familiar figure, and who knows what he said to Jacqueline. She'd made it very clear she wanted it to be over, regardless of the fact that she had to testify on Harvey's behalf. He approached the apartment with a .32 caliber revolver. He was in the public hallway of the apartment at first, the thought being that he approached Jacqueline's apartment to talk. But not much discussion would happen, as the moment Jacqueline was approached by Harvey in the hallway, he pulled out a gun and began to shoot her. He shot her once and she retreated into the apartment to the bedroom. The first bullet was impactful, but Harvey continued to chase her inside. She made it to her room when Harvey approached her and shot her repeatedly again. That is when she staggered to the living room, but in the chaotic scene, Harvey followed her once more and continued shooting her. Jacqueline bled out and died in her apartment at the hands of Harvey, holding a gun over her. Subsequently, without the testimony of Jacqueline, the rape charges made against Harvey were dropped. But the public shootout resulted in Harvey's arrest. It was clear he was the culprit. In fact, Jacqueline's mother states that a few weeks before the murder, Harvey threatened to get Jacqueline after she repeatedly told him things were over. When asked why he killed Jacqueline, Harvey was clear. Jacqueline was popular and loved, and if he couldn't have her, no one else could. He stated he had images of her just being nice to somebody else. Yeah, sexually, you know, she was beautiful. But but quote, I didn't want anyone else to have her. When Harvey's trial came, the jury was split on his sentencing, ultimately with the judge deciding on life in prison. But it didn't last long. Yeah, you heard me right. He killed his ex in cold blood, and instead of being left in prison forever, he was released in 1984. His sentence was actually 20 to life, and he managed to get out on parole. But, like, how? He went up against the parole board multiple times. In fact, in 1997, he even admitted to having a problem with women. He didn't trust women or respect them or like them. They revolted him. And in 1985, he would prove that again. Harvey was out of jail in 1984, and no sooner than that did he meet a new woman. Anna Laura Serrera Miranda. I wish that I could tell you more about Anna, but what I can tell you is that she deserved much more than what was given to her in 1985. The two got together quickly and moved in together even faster. The relationship was rocky, however. They argued over finances, with Anna allegedly being late on rent. But more so, Harvey was controlling. He spoke about how he and Anna would get into arguments on the whereabouts of Anna. She allegedly disappeared for days at a time, which could have been because Harvey was a hard person to live with and be around. It also could have been due to Anna's alleged past. It concerned me that there was next to nothing I could find on her. It was revealed, however, that Anna was 29 years old, about 20 years Harvey's junior. She also happened to be a heroin addict and a sex worker who was in and out of homelessness. It isn't lost on me that usually people struggling with drug addiction or homelessness are lost in the cracks. I also think that Harvey took advantage of this. He himself was an alcoholic. Even when he was with Florence and Jacqueline, he was known to abuse alcohol and cocaine and was in and out of psychiatric care. He also was abusive, both of Jacqueline before his rape allegation and subsequently to Anna. This was much of the same in October of 1985. The two were in a huge argument. From Harvey's track record, I can only imagine that he was the aggressor, and what he does next is nothing short of escalation. Harvey lunged at Anna with a knife and stabbed Anna repeatedly, over and over and over, until he was exhausted. He didn't stop there. Harvey had only been out a year and needed to find a way to get rid of Anna, a person he'd assumed would easily be forgotten. Harvey pulled a larger knife out and began to chop Anna's body up into smaller pieces. After dismembering her, Harvey placed what was left of the dismantled body into dark plastic bags and loaded them into a shopping cart. He then proceeded to place the body parts at an entrance to Central Park. It makes you wonder what the point of chopping Anna up was. If it wasn't to buy time, maybe it was simply for enjoyment. The couple lived together, and it didn't take police long to find Anna. Harvey's home was riddled in DNA evidence. Who knows if Harvey even put enough effort in actually cleaning? Harvey was open about the murder. He stated in a Post article when asked if he did it, quote, well, yeah. Harvey pled guilty to manslaughter and was sentenced to 6 to 12 years in 1986. Manslaughter. Yeah. What the fuck? I don't understand how this was an accident. He stabbed and cut up his girlfriend after shooting his ex-girlfriend 20 years prior, with his wife maybe missing, by the way. Like, we aren't sure where she is. Best case scenario, she got far away from Harvey. But worst case scenario? I wish this is where I could tell you that the story ends. But it takes 3 murders to make a serial killer. And we are at 2 and an alleged missing person. Now a reminder, Harvey was on lifetime parole and during the sentencing was denied parole about 15 times. Instead of doing the 12-year sentence, he ended up doing 33 years, but was granted parole in 2019 and was released at the age of 81. By this time, Harvey had transitioned and was now going by Marceline Harvey instead of Harvey Marceline. From here on out, I will refer to her as Marceline. During her time in prison, she met a transgender inmate at the Auburn State Prison in 1993, who encouraged her to use hormone therapy. Marceline began to make other changes, leaning into different forms of spirituality. She spoke about tarot cards and having them taken away from her, and upon her release, they were one of the first things she had in her apartment. Marceline, at the time of her release, donned a short stringy wig and bright lipstick and had aged drastically, which was different from the fair-skinned, tall person who entered the prison. Marceline was 81 at this point, and she wanted to turn her life around. She explained getting out of prison in 2019 was orgasmic. She thought she'd never get out and joked about her release, saying it was due to her, quote, sucking ass. Her time out consisted of her living in an LGBTQ shelter. She frequented a park and used her charm to make friends and a mini cult. Well, she called them her coven. Marceline and a few other women in the area had a coven, she explained. That's where she kept people in line, and eventually at 81 was, quote, ruling the park. Women in the park worshipped her. She was the queen. She explained, though, that some took her for granted and disrespected her, and that her Harvey side would risk erupting there. She defined her rage as liberating. Quote, you get all that dirt out, you know, the pent-up stress. You can let your macho side come out. It isn't what you wanted to come out, though. You're covering it up by being a woman because you don't like this male with this male rage. You don't want that person loose. Of the two identities, she said she prefers Marceline but laughs when asked about Harvey. He's a pimp, she said. You like him, don't you? She then suggested a Post reporter go with her on a date to Anton's wine bar downtown, presuming she beats her current rap. Expressing your emotions is healthy, but not in the way Marceline did it, because hers was deadly. It may have to do with what happened to Susan Layden on February of 2022. Susan Layden was born on December 18th, 1953. She was a New York native, born in Yonkers to Claire and Nat Evans. Susan was the middle child out of four siblings. When Susan was two, she moved to Teaneck, New Jersey, which I just wanted to lighten the mood for a minute. I'm from New Jersey, and I had a boyfriend who lived in Teaneck. He used to come visit me at lunch in high school, and to this day, people think I made him up. Shout out to you, Pat. Okay, anyway, Susan graduated from Teaneck High School in 1972, and she met her high school sweetheart turned husband, Stephen Layden. The two were married in 1976 to 1992. Susan was a creative. Her career began in New York City's garment district. She loved fashion and was known to have incredible taste. Things were difficult for her in the 70s. She was married but lost her father and two of her brothers, seemingly back to back. This may have began her own trajectory with struggling with her mental health. In 1992, she was a single mother to her daughter, Nicole, and working 7 days a week to build her own jewelry business. This catapulted her into trying to live a life of independence and love. Susan was known as vivacious. She was always laughing and loved her friends, who became family among her losses. However, the past 12 years, though there was triumph, Susan had struggled. At one point, her mental health began to really take a toll on her. It may have been how she came in contact with the likes of Marceline. It isn't clear if Susan was in her coven, but she was familiar with Marceline due to being an LGBTQ activist who lived in Brooklyn Cypress Hills neighborhood. On February 27th, Susan's family thought Susan was living her life normally, running errands, creating jewelry, doing something activist-based, but it was strange when her daughter Nicole hadn't heard from her. She began to get worried. Her mother had her struggles. Could she have gone missing on her own? However, what was odd was that she was missing in the same Cypress Hill area in which Marceline lived. Police began combing through phone records and Susan's social media. That's where they found that she and Marceline had been communicating. They'd been speaking for around 2 years, which was about the time that Marceline had gotten out of prison. Police continued to search until March 3rd, when a shopping cart on Pennsylvania and Atlantic in East New York was reported to police by a passerby. How horrifying to discover this. Inside was a headless and limbless, bloody torso. It didn't take long to identify that torso as belonging to Susan. Police continued to ask questions regarding Susan, and they found out that she hadn't only been friends with Marceline, but they met in person. She was one of three women who occasionally stayed at Marceline's apartment. A woman named Jillian also stayed. Now, a few things occur at this point. Jillian is questioned by police and immediately cooperated and was cleared of doing the actual murder. The other anonymous woman and Marceline, a different story. Susan was known to be with them. A question on if she considered herself part of the coven had still not been answered. It also wasn't clear where the rest of Susan was. A few days later, however, her leg was found a few blocks away. It was cut off at the knee. Police checked Marceline's apartment footage again, and this time saw a pixelated video of Marceline holding trash bags and bringing them to a dumpster. Now, the most bizarre part of this is Marceline's actions. During this time, she was known to ride around in her electric wheelchair when out. Maybe in this case, it was because she thought she could use it to her advantage. In an unmarked video footage, Marceline is seen riding and sitting on top of a plastic bag, entering a 99-cent store. Police were able to determine that inside that bag was Susan's severed leg. Now, whether this was the one that was disposed of or the other is not clear, but police had evidence of Marceline disposing of trash bags, Susan entering Marceline's apartment, and now footage of Marceline wheeling around town sitting on a human leg wrapped in a trash bag. Needless to say, police obtained a warrant and were able to enter Marceline's apartment, which was nothing short of a house of horror, consisting of Susan's severed head and the rest of her limbs, along with blood, cleaning supplies, a hammer, and a box for an electric saw. Police arrested Marceline Harvey and charged her with the murder. Jillian was working with police, and this third woman, we don't actually know if she exists. See, according to Marceline Harvey, she was being framed, and that Jillian, who confirmed with police that she and Marceline went to Home Depot to get supplies, is innocent. But a third woman, that's the woman that murdered Susan. According to Marceline, this mystery woman was jealous of Susan. Does it sound familiar? An autopsy was done on Susan and found that she died of homicidal violence, including blunt force trauma, and was later dismembered. Police arrested Marceline, who seemed to walk strong while being taken to jail to await trial. Since being incarcerated again, Marceline complained about not having her tarot cards. She also speaks about her disdain for her current lawyers or public defenders. In the past, Marceline had a trepidatious relationship with her attorneys during all of her arrests and incarcerations. She acted as her own attorney on a number of cases and was known to ask for new trials. She complained about an all-female parole board once and tried to get in on a class action lawsuit in 1971. Now, as she stays incarcerated, she talks about how she wants a better lawyer and cries about the food in jail. It's either she's in another world or truly doesn't give a fuck. Either way, she's dangerous and will await her fate in prison where she can't hurt anyone. As for Susan, Jacqueline, Anna, Clementine, and Florence, they deserved so much better. There was violence against multiple women, and for three of them, it was fatal. How Marceline was able to make the system work for her in the past is beyond me. But let's hope third time is the charm in this case, and she stays away where she is no longer a threat. Obviously, I was able to cover a lot of Susan's story. I didn't have much on Anna or Jacqueline's story, but I know that these women were living their life. It always creeps me out, the idea of people with aspirations, whether it's a new job or a new relationship or getting clean or finishing school or designing jewelry or just happy that they got out of bed. And life is just suddenly gone. Taken, rather. All I can say is I'm sorry to these women. I'm sorry the system failed you. I'm sorry you couldn't be saved in time. But you mattered. Your story mattered. And though it took 50 years, this monster can't hurt anyone else. So may God rest your souls. Thank you all for joining me, and welcome to a new season. All my sources from today's episode are on my website. I'll be back next week with a true crime fact, a new story to tell, and the same old closing. Safe journey. Keep walking the light. With love. Till next time, Ivana Estelle.